Fascinating discussion, Knowledge Apocalypse, X-Facts, with Jason Martell. And we'll be back with more with Jason in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, we're with Jason Martell. Jason, you've come across an interesting tidbit here. I want to get your take on it. Indigenous South American people are dark-skinned, dark-haired, yet so many of their gods are depicted as tall, pale-skinned gods, white hair. Why?
Well, you know, the research that I've done, George, into the Sumerian culture and looking at the Anunnaki are described as basically they look like us. They created us in their image and after their likeness, as a lot of the Sumerian texts describe. And they're basically tall, pale-skinned beings. I mean, very similar to us. But what's really interesting is that whether they're the Anunnaki or not, around the globe, we have stories of a description of a god coming and visiting areas that the native people, you would think, would have a god that looks more akin to them. And what we find in places like South America, there are various god references of Viracocha and Kukulcan that come to visit, you know, these people, and they're always depicting their god, well, as a tall being with pale skin and white hair. As an example, we have the spot of in Palenque, the King Pakal, another South American god king, is again described to be, you know, pale skin, you know, and he's 7 to 8 feet tall, and they actually buried him in a sarcophagus under a great pyramid there in Mexico. Now, what's really interesting, again, is that the reference of his coffin looks like he is actually taking off in a rocket ship. So one has to wonder why that, one, there are references on various continents that, you know, people of dark skin, indigenous to various regions, have a god that is very similar across the continents that does not fit their genetic makeup. So it really starts to raise the question as to why they're referencing, you know, their great teacher as a being that always comes down from the heavens and does not look pretty much anything like them.
Well, and I was gonna ask you if, you know, they could have been Eastern Europeans or Europeans that came over, but they always are depicted as, just as you said, coming down from the sky.
Right. They never say that their gods came across the lake or down from the mountains. They always cited these beings as coming from the heavens. And George, you know, as we've been talking about this subject tonight, for understanding precession as a new piece of a puzzle to understand in our cycle of time, it really starts to raise a lot of questions about knowledge given to ancient man. Was it either given to them by a being from the heavens, you know, like Viracocha to the South American people? Or is there also a mix of lost information that we seem to come into enlightenment, if you will, through different ages of time, and we lose this information? But what's really interesting is it seems that many cultures were aware of this cycle and said, well, for us to convey this to the next round of knowledge, when we come into this knowledge, let's build monuments and edifices to show that we were also aware of these specific points in time where we were much higher advanced in our consciousness. So, you know, just kind of restating back to this precession cycle, I mean, beyond the technical considerations, a moving solar system appears to provide a much more logical reason for why there is a great year. Plato's term of a great year is that we come in and out of these alternating dark and golden ages. So, if a solar system carrying Earth actually moves in a huge orbit, subjecting Earth to the electromagnetic spectrum of another EM source, like our sun, but other worlds, it's very possible that, you know, these effects, these electromagnetic effects, will have an effect on our magnetosphere, our ionosphere, and possibly life as we know it here on Earth. So it's an interesting idea that there has been some research. For instance, at UCLA, there was a Dr. Valerie Hunt who did studies in changes in ambient electromagnetic fields and how it affects human cognition and performance. In short, she found out that basically subtle fields of light actually affect our consciousness. So it's an interesting idea to think about this age of precession that we go through, this cycle of precession. As our two suns in a binary orbit come closer together, we actually have effects happening in our solar system that might actually explain a lot of what we're seeing by this model. Most of the people, as you've mentioned many times, Richard Hoagland, you know, he has a very esoteric view of hyperdimensional physics happening at certain areas on every planet at a certain longitude or latitude. I think it's 3.14. I forgot what his thing is. But the point is that maybe there's some validity to why every planet in our solar system is heating up, or why there are effects taking place on our planet that we can't explain. If we understand that there are gravitational and electromagnetic effects caused by other planets to us, just like the moon affects our tides, it puts this idea of precession into a whole new line of thinking to suggest that as our sun rotates around this other binary star and is curving through space, we're gonna get introduced to new electromagnetic energies, whether they be other stars that are now closer to us, other planets perhaps around our second sun that could be affecting us. And again, this is where the science starts to cross over. There was a gentleman named Richard Mueller at, I forget actually where he was teaching, I believe it's at Stanford, but he did some new models and showing that, you know, in a binary solar system, it's very possible that our second sun also has planets orbiting it. And, you know, his theory was that there was another planet called Nemesis that orbits our second sun. And while it orbits our second sun, it passes through a very large asteroid belt called the Oort cloud. We know it exists. It's billions of miles beyond Pluto. So very possibly in this Oort cloud of asteroids is our second sun. And around this second sun, Dr. Mueller theorized that there's another planet called Nemesis that, while orbiting around the second sun, dislodges comets and asteroids and hurls them towards our inner part of the solar system. So there's a lot of very interesting models to explain the idea that, you know, effects from precession with a binary model can really explain a lot of interesting pieces. And, George, what we'll talk about here at some point tonight is how this affects the orbit of Nibiru. All of the models put forth by Zachariah Sitchin show a knowledge of 12 members in a solar system, and that Nibiru orbits around our one sun every 3,600 years.
That's right. And I've always wondered how it keeps its own heating system, but it could be done from within.
Yes, and it also can explain how it can go way far into the reaches of the depths of space and then somehow orbit back around towards us. That can be a lot more easily explained when we incorporate a binary solar system, meaning it loops around our sun, it speeds up as it comes towards our sun, loops around, and then as it approaches the far depths of space, it starts to speed up again and loops back around from our second sun. So I have to do some new research in creating some planetary models of incorporating Nibiru's orbit into a binary solar system. And I really think that there's a lot of information that can be learned through this, because we're now introducing a new variable to understand that many of the ancient cultures were not only, one, aware of precession, but recorded astronomical events over thousands of years. And again, some of these megaliths, like the Giza pyramids, like Stonehenge, like Angkor Wat, have been anchored or marked at specific times based on an astronomical calendar of time. So we forget that our calendar is based upon movements of the heavens. Our year, 365 days, is defined by us looping around the sun once. It takes 365 days. So looking at solar orbits and understanding that we rule our life and time based upon the movements in the heavens, it really is an interesting thing to note that many different cultures, the Mayans, the Egyptians, went to great lengths to record their view of the heavens at different stages in time along this cycle of 24,000 years. They understood it somehow and made adjustments in their life to incorporate when it was good or bad times to make decisions of great importance.
You know, the Bible talks about how we were made in God's image. I find it uncannily close to the Sumerians and their discussions, of course, that the Anunnaki built us in their image. Could we be talking about the same thing?
I think so, George. I you know, in looking at the research done by Zachariah Sitchin, with 50 years of research, God rest his soul, 50 years, that's 50, he really took a very esoteric approach in a non-mainstream view of looking at all of the information, all of the biblical information in its entirety as a whole and complete story to explain in a very logical way. Most scholars today will argue over one word or one interpretation. But Zachariah Sitchin did a very interesting, you know, approach of looking at all this information from a global perspective. So it seems across the board we have these references of beings that visited us. And, you know, talking about one culture specifically, ancient Iraq, there is, you know, a pretty good amount of evidence to show that, you know, the Sumerians went to great lengths to record how these beings, the Anunnaki, created us in their image and after their likeness. The Bible basically says that word for word. The kicker of the information is the Sumerian culture has all of the biblical tales that we have today, the renowned stories of the Garden of Eden or Noah's Ark, the Great Flood. All of these stories that we have today are preserved in an original Sumerian form in stone, and they're thousands of years predating any of the religious tales that we have today in the Old Testament, the Hebrew version, or the New King James version. These tales can be found in a much more drawn-out version, thousands of years predating the current Bible in Sumerian. And as you said, George, yes, the Anunnaki, as stated in these texts, are actually literally the gods of the Sumerian culture. They created the Sumerians in their image and after their likeness. If we were to just look at this as a story and say, oh, that's nice, that sounds like some nice mythology.
It sure does.
A lot of people don't realize that the word mythology actually stems from the root word mythos. And that word carried through time, Greeks and Romans and such, it was mythos, meant words or knowledge of great importance held to be true by kings and priests and passed down as sacred information. And somehow over time, mythos turned into mythology. So there is a parallel there that the Anunnaki is described by the Sumerians. The Sumerians have a very accurate representation of, you know, this depicting and explaining how the Anunnaki created us in their image and after their likeness. More than likely, they used some type of process like genetic in vitro fertilization. Test tube babies and such. There's actual depictions by the Sumerians where they have texts, you know, actual texts in stone, as well as pictograms, pictures, visual pictograms, explaining how they created the Anunnaki, created the first Adam. So just like the Bible says, Adam and Eve, well, the Sumerian tales, you know, told by the Anunnaki and recorded in this ancient text, cuneiform script, the Sumerians very clearly explain how the Anunnaki created us in their image and after their likeness. So it's a very interesting tale, and there's a lot of these texts that are bequeathed to us from the Sumerian culture where they say everything they know, they were taught by these beings that come from another planet within our own solar system. And so again, we have to wonder, how is this possible that they would be, you know, a 6,000-year-old culture, but being very accurate in explaining not only where their gods came from and explaining the distance between the outer planets, all the science that we know of to explain the cosmology of our solar system, But they're very clear in saying, hey, there's another planet out there on this highly elliptical orbit, and that's where our gods come from. Now, the whole idea of a planet on a large elliptical orbit is something that, again, science had to confirm by seeing through the Hubble, oh, wow, look, there's another solar system, a sun, and it has a planet. This planet is orbiting that star in an elongated egg-shaped orbit.
But do you think this is a planet or another star?
Well, and so this is where this whole new line of thinking of precession with a binary system comes into play, George, is that the Sumerians were very clear in depicting the fact that even during daylight, they saw a sun and they saw a glowing cross in the sky, which they depicted as Nibiru. Nibiru was depicted as two different symbols, a winged disc, and that was carried over to various other cultures like the Egyptian sun god Ra and other Semitic languages.
Mm-hmm.
But what's really interesting is the fact that it's also shown by the Sumerians over and over as a winged disc, also as a cross, as it was being close to Earth. Nibiru was always symbolized as a glowing cross in the sky as it was in the vicinity of Earth.
Well, it's pretty remarkable, Jason, that the ancients had so much knowledge. You know, let's go to the pyramids for a second. How in the heck did they build those?
Well, that's another anomaly is the fact that not only are there pyramids that date back thousands of years, but they're on every single continent. One has to wonder how it's possible that there's similar architecture on every continent and a knowledge being shared at a time when, again, we didn't think transoceanic contact was possible. But, you know, aside from seeing pyramids on every single continent, we also see similar types of structures and edifices that show, you know, contact was taking place. Not only similar building styles, pyramids, but, you know, for instance, sites like Markawasi, or as you mentioned earlier, Göbekli Tepe, there are carved reliefs of animals and people that are not found indigenous to the continent where these structures are built. They, for instance, in Markawasi show, you know, people from Africa and animals from different continents. And this really starts to raise the question as to how this would be possible. You know, some of these reports are true. It indicate that there was a pre-Columbian culture that had transoceanic ties. And just perhaps it represents a branch of, you know, some lost global civilization that, you know, writers like Plato and others reference as an Atlantean culture. I always often wonder, you know, why we see pyramids on every continent might suggest the fact that there was an advanced culture at one point, 10, 15,000 years ago, off the recorded books of history. But if they were an advanced civilization, then they would have been a global civilization. And that's exactly what we see, are megaliths on every single continent, where if you ask the ancient people, they say, these were built by a much older race, and we don't really know who they were. We have these monuments all over the earth, like Sacsayhuaman, Teotihuacan, Pumapunku, as an example, is one of the most infamous and famous that I like, simply because of the fact that the remains are next to Lake Titicaca, and it's just such a massive stone undertaking of blocks fashioned in such a way that even if we think the pyramids are complex, some of these megaliths like Pumapunku show a type of architecture literally like Legos being accurately fit to build a very advanced type of structure. But a lot of these places have a type of building technique. And again, it's not just in one location. It's across the board on every single continent. They had some type of process of using a mortarless way to build these megaliths where the stones used in these constructions are one of such a large size. There'd be hundreds of tons. We today still can't figure out how they were built. And again, pyramids alike, some of these structures like Pumapunku have a style of the way the stones are literally made almost like cement blocks, duplicating the exact style of a stone over and over. It seems like they had a process, George, of actually creating stones in a molten form.
Well, they sure did, Jason. No doubt. We'll be back. We'll take your phone calls next hour with Jason Martell. I'll be back with him in a moment, though, on Coast to Coast AM. Let's talk, if we can, about some of the rocket ships and other craft that are depicted in the ancient depictions. What do we have here, Jason?
Well, you know, a lot of people ask me, because I lecture so much specifically on the Sumerian culture, they ask me, well, why is it that the Sumerians have so many depictions of rocket ships? If they were visited by advanced beings called the Anunnaki, why would they be coming in rocket ships? Don't know. But what I do recognize is that across the board, there are references, for whatever reason, of a type of flight very characteristic to our modern-day rocket ships. Some of these sites are actually, you know, postulated to be landing sites. Sacsayhuaman, Baalbek in Lebanon, these megalithic platforms of Tlalipatan stones are theorized to have been landing platforms. Why do we say this? Because ancient tales tell us that the gods ascended and descended from these various locations, and there was always loud, thunderous noise, flames, and smoke, very similar to what we hear with a modern-day rocket launch. And where the kicker of this, George, is that there's actual depictions that they've left us where, you know, very clearly they're depicting a rocket ship. One of the seals, as an example, is a seal that's around 4,500 BC, so it's, you know, well over 6,000 years old, and it shows a complete model of our solar system. Just as a backdrop in this seal, it shows the solar system that we know of correctly with the sun in the center, but also it shows, for whatever intents and purposes, a rocket ship on the launch pad with the two pillars. You know, and we see this in various references from the Sumerian culture.
They couldn't have been that creative for just being artists. They had to have seen something.
Right, right. And it's not only the Sumerian culture. It's across the board. You know, for instance, as I mentioned, in Baalbek, this landing platform, there's an actual Phoenician coin. An old coin that denotes showing Baalbek as the platform, and on top of the platform is a rocket ship. It's a small cone, cylindrical shaped cone, and it's being depicted as standing on top of this large platform. That's one depiction on a coin. The cylinder seal showing the rocket on its launch pad. Now, that's only the Sumerian culture. They had various references in that culture to actually explain. They had a word. They called it a shem. And a shem was basically a top part of a space capsule that it basically detached from the space capsule, and they used that to land and take off from the surface of the Earth. The shem is basically what looks like a large cone. It's in the shape of a rocket ship. Well, the kicker, George, is that it's not just in the Sumerian culture. We have, for instance, a Mayan rocket ship. King Pakal at Palenque, his sarcophagus has a very intricate carving on the cover. And some interpret it, as I do, that he's seated in a large rocket ship. You can actually see him manipulating gears and levers. There's what appears to be an engine on the bottom part of the sarcophagus. So, and he's even seated in a position similar to the astronauts when they're inclined in a rocket ship. Zachariah Sitchin found another rocket ship in Turkey that he called the Headless Spaceman.
Mm-hmm.
The curator of the museum said, well, we're not going to put this on display because it's not a rocket ship. That's just not possible. And Zachariah, because of his prominence, said, well, you know, why don't you put it on display and let the people decide? And very clearly, it's a rocket ship. It looks just like the space shuttle, but you can actually see a gentleman seated. His legs are all cramped up, just like we see an astronaut getting into a rocket today. It's very cramped. And it has an engine coming out the back. So, you know, Mayan rocket ships, Sumerian rocket ships, even in Egypt, in an area called the Kush Mine, there are reliefs that very, you know, could be interpreted as a rocket ship. Another area in Egypt called Abydos has not only what appear to be a rocket ship, but a helicopter, a plane.
A submarine.
A submarine, that's right. And so, you know, across the board from various cultures, and I don't want to forget India, of course, and their references of Vimana and their flying craft, across the board there are references of the power of flight. The rocket ships, of course, have always been very intriguing as an anomaly, because we would think that if it's an advanced extraterrestrial race, we immediately think of a circular craft. It's a UFO that's coming in. But, you know, I often tell people that it's very possible. Yes, they were, the Anunnaki, they were using rocket ships. However, the propellant that they were using probably was not a terrestrial-based Earth propellant. Maybe they have some type of solid rocket fuel or something that burns much more efficiently than our rocket fuel that we would use here, whether it be solid or liquid. You know, it's very possible that we were using some type of technique that we've seen from ancient times. However, a rocket ship isn't that ancient or primitive when you think about somehow they were able to use these devices to come and go from their planet to here. And that's what all the evidence is depicting.
Let's spend a little time on the Mayans, then we'll go to phone calls at the top of the hour. Here we are rapidly approaching now December 21st, 2012. It's a little more than a year away. What's going to happen, in your opinion?
Well, the problem is that there's such a widely accepted paradigm for, you know, basically over the last 100 years, major discoveries have been made in a few areas like Mesopotamia, South America, the Indus Valleys. And it's really starting to break the norm and understanding of a cycle of time. The Mayans are one of the most infamous known because of their calendar, and they say that the time of this current era ends in 2012. So many people look at this information and are confused and say, my God, it's the end of time as we know it. It's not the end of time as we know it. It's the end of time as the Mayans knew it. So what seems to be intriguing to me, George, is a new shift in understanding that, again, there is a much larger cycle of time that's cyclic that the ancients knew of, including the Mayans. And they recorded events as markers along this path. Now, some of those markers are predictions. The Mayans, as an example, have three different calendars. One of their calendars, called the Long Count calendar, made predictions in various time epics they called Baktun.
And predictions of what, Jace?
Predictions of things to come. As an example, one of those was when their god Kukulkan would return, a prediction on what date their god would return. And we're going to talk about that one, too, right after this topic, is predicting when the gods will return based upon astronomical cycles. So they depicted a time as saying, Kukulkan is going to return on this specific date. And that was a prediction they made. Unfortunately, not all of their predictions came true. Their calendar system, extremely accurate, but predicting what would happen on certain events, not always so accurate. As an example, they said the conquistadors, they said that their god Kukulkan would return on a certain epoch of time. Well, in this time, in this epoch, the conquistadors show up on the shores of the Mayan coast.
Wrong ones,
Right. And so they, you know, think that the conquistadors are the returning gods. They're amazed, and they let them into their culture. They offer them gold and all their precious, things, their codices, their Mayan codices of knowledge, unbelievable sacred knowledge passed down. And so what did the conquistadors do? Well, they aggressively convert all the Mayans to Christianity and burn all of the codices, leaving us with only four that we still revere today as going, wow, they knew something. But we don't have the complete picture because we only have a portion of their codices.
Yet the Mayans, Jason, were astrological geniuses.
Yes. They were. They tracked the heavens. And just like the Sumerians or various other cultures, they had accurate information that they recorded over hundreds of years watching the movements of the heavens. Now, where this again starts to cross over into this new line of thinking of interest to me is the fact that these markers in time recorded in the heavens as astronomical points, they seem to know that these were repeating events. And so certain pieces of information that they recorded as markers on their megaliths with alignments astronomically seem to pinpoint time in space, places in time and space where there was advanced knowledge coming into awareness, either by beings visiting us or just knowledge that they seem to be aware of that was passed down from much earlier cultures. And all of this revolves around an understanding of the movements of the heavens.
How could they do this without high-tech equipment?
So there's only two answers, George, which is one, beings from the heavens, more advanced, spiritually and technologically, came here and visited us and gave ancient man this knowledge, which is what a lot of the cultures say. Unfortunately, we call it mythology today. Or somehow this was lost knowledge from other cultures that we don't have on the books now, and somehow the Mayans and various others were aware of this information and took it into their own knowledge base. The part that gets really interesting, again, is that confirming the fact that many of these cultures were aware of a much larger cycle of time that's beyond the scope of what we can see today. So it makes it hard for us to understand that there could be, you know, things that will affect us as we go through this cycle of time. It's just hard for us to conceive that there's, you know, actual things that could affect the global consciousness of the Earth. But when saying things like that, let's just back it up and put it into perspective that, you know, the moon has gravitational effects on us. As we orbit the Earth, there are effects as plants wanting to sprout, animals decay, the seasons of our Earth change based upon the orbit of the sun. Why is it not feasible then at a much larger cycle as we actually move through space, as our sun curves through space in this larger cycle, we're going to have effects. There are going to be effects on us. We can't see them yet, or we can't perceive them. But I think this, George, is what a lot of the ancient cultures, like the Mayans, are referring to. We're going to come into a new cycle of time that will have effects on us.
When you talk about the return of the gods, isn't it interesting that in Christianity, we talk about the return, the second coming of Jesus?
Right.
I mean, there's got to be some similarities here, don't you think?
I think there is, George. We are now currently in the age of Pisces, which is the Christian symbol of a fish. In about 150 years or so, we're going to start to enter the age of Aquarius. And basically on the cycle of time, the great year, where many cultures recorded us going in from dark ages into the golden age, we're now entering a time where we're just starting the upswing from coming out of the Iron Age and into the Bronze Age, the Aquarius Age, where for whatever intents and purposes, we're now entering a time where human beings, according to this great cycle of time, this 24,000-year cycle, we're now coming back into a time where we're coming out of the Dark Ages and going into the Golden Age. We're far off from the Golden Age, but we're going in that direction. And so it's a very interesting similarity to see that all the quickening of our knowledge is happening with our own sciences here on Earth, our advances in technology, our understandings of the solar system. It's allowing us to look back on the ancients, like the Mayans, and go, huh, wait a minute. How did they know this? We're just now learning this with our advances in science. But what if we're not just learning it now? What if we've learned it over many, many times, and then we forget it? So this is a really interesting piece of the puzzle to incorporate this cyclical pattern on a 24,000-year cycle where humanity seems to go through different epochs of time of being more consciously able to process knowledge faster. And we're now going into that age exponentially. We're going into a new age where knowledge will come to us exponentially faster. I think that's what the Mayans are referring to.
Could we have been the gods of the past, and then civilizations got wiped out, and they remembered a little bit, and that we just moved on?
I think so, George. I think that there is, there's never a black and white answer. I think there's some gray area here, which is somehow we've been coming in and out of consciousness, losing great epics of knowledge. But there's also another piece, meaning it's just not sustainable on Earth where we're going through this process. I think there are also outside influences, extraterrestrial influence, simply because not only is there knowledge of this great cycle and a repeating pattern of coming into knowledge and losing the knowledge, but there's also clear evidence from every culture that beings from the heavens gave us knowledge. Again, they never came from the mountains or across the lakes. Every culture references visitation from advanced beings that came from the skies. So then I start to have to wonder, George, well, okay, maybe there's a correlation of when humanity is at a certain time in this 24,000-year cycle that it's more akin to us being receptive to meeting other advanced cultures, meaning, 1,000 years ago, just as we were coming out of the Dark Ages, I don't think it might not have been the best time for advanced species to be interacting with humanity. As we now start to approach a new age of consciousness with technology and spirituality, maybe we're very quickly becoming to the point where extraterrestrials that are monitoring us know that we're coming into that state of it's time to interact with us again. And that's the interesting point of all the ancient cultures recorded saying, hey, the gods were here and they will come back. But when will they return? And how do we pinpoint these events? It seems like there are markers marked by all the cultures in an esoteric way to say, hey, we're aware of this cycle. And at certain points along this cycle, things happen of great importance. So we mark them in monuments as markers in time and in megaliths to show that we were aware that at certain points in this cycle, George, either there's an interaction with these advanced beings or somehow, through cosmic energy or electromagnetic energy in space that we're going to get affected to, are affected by, our consciousness is actually going to shift and somehow we're going to start to learn things exponentially faster. I think we might already be in that age now.
Paint the scenario then for us, Jason. What do you think happened on this planet a long time ago?
In my opinion, there has been a cyclical pattern of events where things happening in the heavens, whether they be asteroids or comets or Nibiru, perhaps passing by the Earth, there are gravitational effects and things that cause things geologically here on Earth to put man in a different epoch of time without our knowledge, whether it be a pole shift and all of a sudden everything's wiped out, whether it be a comet or an asteroid that impacts Earth and wipes everything out. There seem to be these cyclical patterns as well that cause a rise and fall of civilization. It's very hard to pinpoint at what scale this is taking place, but we do see evidence geologically to say that there has been various epochs that have caused, a devastation globally. So that's another thing that I wonder about, is saying that, a lot of these markers in time of saying, things happened of great importance in the past, what will happen in the future? It seems that an awareness of astronomical information was very prominent by the ancients. The Sumerians, as an example, recorded the movements of the heavens over hundreds of years. They could literally tell you on a specific day when there would be a lunar or a solar eclipse. So that, to me, George, raises the question of, are we going to know of the next devastation based on ancient sacred information that we need to put into a different light to give us these answers?
We're going to come back and take some phone calls now with Jason Martell as we talk about the ancient astronauts and Planet X right here on Coast to Coast AM.